Hey everyone, batter up, and welcome to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I am joined tonight by everyone's favorite first baseman, Adam Riske.
Put me in, coach. I'm ready to play today.
We're talking about The Sandlot. That's why we're making all the baseball jokes, everyone.
It's more America than Kevin Costner apple pie and a hug
and Kevin
the American
Costner
flag.
Pie.
Costner pie?
Yeah.
Sweet.
A little bit of that sweet Costner pie. That's why I love the Postman.
Mm-hmm. Benny the Jet Rodriguez hands out hope like it's candy in his pocket.
Thank you for quoting that line from the Postman. That's my favorite line from the Postman.
I like all the lines.
Do
from
you
want to
be? Oh gosh, what's his name? What's Lorenz's Tate? Ford. It's two cars.
Ford. Taurus?
It's not Ford Taurus. It's not Ford Mustang.
It's another make.
Yeah.
Ford Honda?
I can't remember.
I don't know.
Everyone watch The Postman and write us at fthismovie.net. Hey, you should go to our website at fthismovie.net, and you should like us on Facebook, and you should follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fthismovie or at fthismovie. And you can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com once you have the answer to our burning Postman questions.
Or if you're just burning and you have a question about how to make it stop, we can recommend some creams at Walgreens.
Yes, we're all big fans of the ointment. Yep. We're going to be talking about The Sandlot in a little bit, I guess, because it's summer and because it celebrated its 20th anniversary this year, which makes us all feel very old.
Very much so.
And because a listener / reader, Tom Farrell, I apologize if I mispronounced your name. Maybe it's Farrell. Maybe you go sort of the Jane's Addiction route. Requested that we do it on our Facebook page, facebook.com/fthismovie. You can always request stuff as well. I can't promise that we're going to do it. It took us a long time to finally get around to doing The Sandlot.
We wanted to do it right.
Exactly.
We've been studying up since
I needed to see it, for starters.
Yeah.
This was my first viewing of The Sandlot. This movie has eluded me for 2 decades.
I'm fascinated to hear your opinion based just off of the fact that you have no history with it as a child.
All right,
you're gonna tip your hat.
Giving up the lead here, but okay. I think you could only like this movie if you saw it as a child. But I could be wrong.
Ooh, well, we're gonna have a good meaty discussion, like a bowl of Campbell's soup,
like a big heaping spoonful of Costner pie.
Also available at Walgreens.
We're gonna be talking about The Sandlot momentarily, but first, Adam Riske, I have to ask: have you seen anything good lately?
I have. I want to say thank you, though, for Junesploitation.
And if
you haven't been participating in Junesploitation yet, definitely go to fthismovie.net and catch up with us over the last few days of June. It's been a lot of fun, and if it weren't for the theme month of Junesploitation, I would still never have seen Miami Connection or Death Wish 3.
Yes. Wow, you saw two really good ones.
And those were two just magical hour and a halves. Miami Connection is a movie that I recommended to so many people since I watched it. And, Grandmaster YK Kim?
Yeah.
He's something else. He's special. And I enrolled into the University of Central Florida after seeing it. So I'm really looking forward to
Miami. There's such a story behind Miami Connection that we won't go into now, but it's from like 87, called Miami Connection, doesn't take place in Miami, focuses on a band called Dragon Sound. They play songs about friendship and ninjas.
Mm-hmm.
It's on Netflix Instant. You guys should watch it. We have a free space day coming up for Junesploitation, and I really feel like everyone should take the opportunity to watch Miami Connection.
Yeah.
Your life will be better.
It will be. It's one of those movies where I watched it for about a half hour, and then I did this with Wet Hot American Summer also, where I'm sitting there and I'm like, I get why people like this, but I'm not like getting it yet. Yeah. And then there was like one moment where I'm like, oh, I completely get why people like this. And then I rewound the movie to the beginning and I watched it from the start because I'm just like, I need to see this under this new frame of reference, and I completely loved it.
The monologue that the guy gives about his parents is one of the best scenes you're ever gonna see.
Yeah, my mother was Korean, my father was Black American.
It's
thought
amazing.
We were all orphans.
It's a great movie, I mean, obviously, we sort of enjoy it ironically, but also not really, because again, the charm of the movie is that it means it.
Yeah, it definitely does. There's no winking at the camera. It's just they love karate. They love kung fu. Speaking of which, the part that I stopped and rewound the movie at, where I fell in love with Miami Connection, was when the guy whose band got fired goes into the club and he's just like yelling over the other character, and he's just not even letting the other guy get his lines in. But you could tell this guy is just like, this is my Stella moment from like Streetcar Named Desire. And he's just chewing that scenery like nobody's business. And
I was on board from the first performance of Dragon Sound because their lyrics are like, friendship, loyalty, honesty, integrity.
Yeah.
And I was sold on the movie.
You're like, you hit my four main points.
Exactly. any movie that is that sincere, I'm on board with.
Yeah. And then speaking of sincere.
Yes.
Monsters University.
Yes.
I saw that and I was very pleasantly surprised by how much I liked it. I really just enjoyed the college aspects of it. I thought it wasn't like a bunch of filmmakers were kind of backtracking and saying, okay, this is a college movie, but we need to make this for kids.
Right.
The stuff that they did with the college experience, I guess, in the movie were things that I recognized from, like, when I was in college. Stuff about, like, you know, your orientation and moving into your dorm and, like, rushing fraternities and things like that. And it was just not in a way where they're, like, throwing pop culture references at you to kind of get the adult audience interested. They were giving you things where you're like, oh, okay, well, I remember things like that, and it makes me have fond memories of when I was in college, and I wasn't expecting that. And I actually liked it, I think, more than Monsters, Inc.
It's been a while. If you guys haven't already read it, you go to fthismovie.net, which is our Russian affiliate. go to fthismovie.net, and Adam wrote a review of it, so you guys should all check that out. I saw it as well. I took my son. I, like you, really liked it. Mm-hmm. And I was always a little bit indifferent towards Monsters, Inc.
Yeah.
I saw it again recently in preparation to see the new one and liked it better than I remembered, but I too might have liked this one better. I was surprised because it is kind of weird on paper. Like, we're going to make this college comedy for a young audience who doesn't understand the references. But I thought they did just a really good job of like making sort of a character based comedy. And as opposed to a lot of sequels where, we are on board because we know the characters and we like the characters. I thought they actually did a really good job of sort of building the characters from scratch, even though we already know them. Like, I think if Monsters, Inc. never existed, this movie still totally works. And it doesn't get into, like, all that prequel garbage.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like a prequel at all.
There's basically one thing that it tries to set up, which is the Steve Buscemi thing.
Yeah, and I liked also, like, if you're going to do a prequel and you have to tie it into the next, or into the original movie, I kind of like how they did it where they basically crammed all that into the last 2 minutes of the movie. And the rest of it was just able to kind of breathe.
And it's kind of weird because the whole sort of plot, I don't think this is a spoiler, hinges on if Mike, the Billy Crystal little eyeball guy, wants to be a scarer. And that's the whole arc of the movie. But because it is a prequel, unfortunately, we sort of already know that he's not, because we've seen Monsters, Inc. So, but I thought the movie still worked in spite of that, because what an interesting theme for a kid's movie that, like, you can really, really, really want it, but that doesn't mean it's going to happen for you. I mean, that's kind of dark. Like,
it is, but I think that it's kind of also positive in the sense that you could really, really want it, and you might not necessarily get it, but he's still able to participate in the scare aspect. It's just he had to go a different way.
Right, it's about sort of finding
adaptability, your strength, like, in something that you love, and like utilizing your strengths.
Right.
And it's different. They gave it a lot of thought.
Yeah.
I wasn't expecting that just based off of how Cars 2 and Brave turned out.
I still haven't seen Brave. I feel bad. It's being sort of dismissed. I mean, people are liking it, but, you know, everybody's sort of saying, well, it's minor Pixar and it's another example of them sequelizing and they're, you know, which is fine. And some of that is true. And you talked about that in your column last week, but I'm amazed at the standard to which we hold Pixar that we don't seem to hold the rest of Hollywood to, because all we're doing is complaining about how Pixar is doing sequels. And meanwhile, I mean, every week they're announcing two more Amazing Spider-Man movies and two more Avengers movies, and people just sort of eat that shit up. And it's like, why are we not holding both of these things to the same standard? Pixar isn't allowed to do what everybody else. And I understand it. Yeah. We want Pixar to do original stuff because they do it so well, but I think people are being a little bit unfair.
I completely agree with you on that, but my solution is I want people to be more unfair to superhero movies.
And so do I. Yeah, I think all movies, all movies. Because the next movie we should talk about, you know, it used to be that you would go see a movie and it had a beginning and a middle and an end. Mm-hmm. And then if you liked the movie and it was a big hit, sometimes they would say, well, let's do a sequel. And a lot of times you would just sort of do the first movie again. And now we don't get movies anymore. We just get like, here's the pilot episode for this new thing that we're trying to launch. And that brings us to World War Z.
The Z stands for this director doesn't know how to shoot action.
He's really shitty, right?
He's the worst action director in the side of Paul Greengrass. I'm sorry, if you like Paul Greengrass, you're wrong.
Here's the thing. I don't want to root for a movie to fail, right? And I like Brad Pitt. I really do. And he's been working like Tom Cruise hard to make World War Z a success. And so I want to be on Brad Pitt's side. I want to be like, you know what? For you, I want this thing to be a hit. However, I feel like if it is a hit, and it basically already is, it teaches so many of the wrong lessons.
Yeah.
I feel like this movie should have failed as an example to Hollywood. Like, don't do the things that you did in this case, because so many of the things that I think make this movie not horrible, but just utterly bland and forgettable.
See, I had a more violent reaction to it than you did. I aggressively hated the movie.
Interesting.
I just was... it's something that I'm going to kind of tease a column I might write for next week, but I'm calling it the Fuck You Jamboree. And Man of Steel... Even stuff I like Star Trek Into Darkness, or, I mean...
So you're just tired of seeing everything destroyed?
I'm tired of seeing everything destroyed. Yeah. I mean, I feel like I should go to, you know, the 30-screen Megaplex and just say, like, yeah, one for how we die, please. And I would like to die tonight in a zombie attack. Or I would like to die in 9/11 times 100. And I'm so sick of just, like, the shitty worldview, and I couldn't get past that enough to even care about how poorly made the movie was.
And that, by the way, is another reason why Monsters University is sort of, like, one of the best surprises of the summer so far, because it didn't end with our city in ruins.
It doesn't hate you.
Right.
Like, the thing that was driving me crazy about World War Z was, all right, you'll inject... And this isn't really a spoiler, it's from the middle of the movie, but, like, they'll inject a little thing where they're saying... Hey, this country is doing it right. They took precautions, and they're also letting people in because they want them to be safe. And then how do we reward them for that? By having a mass killing of them but zombies. Yeah. And cool, some of them get away, but how about we blow up the airplane that they're on where they're getting away? And it's just like, you know what? Go fuck yourself, movie.
The movie is a huge mess. I feel like we could do a whole show on World War Z, because the movie's a huge mess, because I forgot about that whole thing. Yeah. It's never really explained, like, why are some countries ahead of the curve, and why were they able to build walls inside of a week? It's crazy, because if you've seen the trailer, and I've seen the trailer a lot, with the exception of sort of that new ending that they went back and reshot, everything from the plane forward is, like, new, with the exception of that stuff, which hasn't been in any of the trailers, I feel like the entire movie has been in the trailers. And that's because it's essentially made up of, like, four big sequences, each of which has been highlighted, punctuated by... So Brad Pitt goes somewhere, and somebody, a general, a doctor, a politician, someone, explains things to him, and then zombies attack. And then he gets on a plane and he flies somewhere else, lands in the exact right spot to meet another general who explains something. Zombies attack. I'm sorry. Every scene is punctuated by a shot of the city with smoke rising and, like, helicopters flying overhead.
Yeah.
Each sequence ends with, and here's this city destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
it's a movie that just, it doesn't understand any of its own moments. There's a scene early on in a pharmacy that I actually think was maybe the best scene in the movie, and had a moment I almost liked where Brad Pitt thinks he's about to be arrested. A cop is walking towards him, and the cop walks right past him to get what I believe was baby food, which is a neat... However, Mark Forster shoots it so poorly that you can't quite tell that it's baby... You can't quite tell what's going on, ever.
Yeah, you can never... Like, there's zombies chasing Brad Pitt and his family in a staircase, and you're just, like, almost ready to close your eyes and just wait for it to be over. Not because you're scared, but just because you know that the filmmaker has no intention of giving you spatial sense of what's going on.
Right.
And you're like, I'm just going to, like, wait it out and just wait till two people are talking. And were you surprised also by how quickly they just kind of get into it?
Yeah, because the movie isn't interested in unfolding or telling a story. It's just like, and zombies. Okay,
well,
go.
Well, it's odd because you see, like, in the trailer, like, three shots of, like, them kind of eating breakfast and stuff. And that's literally what's in the movie.
I'm telling you, if you've seen the trailer, you've basically seen the movie.
Yeah.
So,
I didn't like
any of the stuff with the family. I'm annoyed at the way it just exists to sort of set up a franchise.
They're the most hated family on Earth because they're so ready to kick them off that boat. Any chance they can, they're just like, that girl tied her shoe. Kick her off the boat.
I thought the special effects were generally bad, which you can kind of tell from the trailer. And yeah, this has been kind of a depressing summer at the movies because all of our big blockbusters deal with a lot of destruction. I was amazed. I don't think this is a spoiler, and I'm sorry if it is. Maybe spoiler for World War Z coming up, but this doesn't give away a plot detail. There's a shot almost near the end of the movie that's literally a bulldozer shoveling bodies onto a bigger pile of bodies, right? It's thousands, if not millions of people die in this movie, and it's a PG-13.
Yep.
Because there's no blood. If we had shown blood, it would be an R. And that seems weirdly hypocritical to me.
It's very hypocritical.
Because why not at least show... I mean, obviously, you know, The Walking Dead isn't dealing with the consequences of violence. They're showing gore for the sake of showing gore. But maybe if you show some blood...
Making a zombie movie that's PG-13 is cynical and calculated to begin
with. This whole exercise is cynical and calculated.
Yeah.
The whole movie.
But... on a lighter note, you caught up with Before Midnight.
I did.
So what'd you? Well, first off, and don't be one of those people who say I can't compare the other two to that one. I need you to rank them right now.
Okay.
Before Sunrise, Before Sunset, and Before
for me
Midnight.
It goes 1, 2, 3.
That's how it goes for me too.
Yeah, and part of that is just because the first one is the happy one, and so if I want to put something on and feel good. I put on the first one. I think the second one is very interesting, and some of the things that it says about the passage of time and not being where we thought we were going to be, I thought it was a really interesting way to drop in on these characters. I liked this one. I didn't love it. I loved the first two.
Yeah, I loved the first one.
Yeah.
The second one, I rewatched both of them recently, and the second one I liked a little bit less than I remembered liking.
Okay.
But the end still hits you like a ton of bricks, and the ending is wonderful.
Yes.
Before Midnight, I actually disliked it up until the part where the two of them are alone together.
Yeah.
Because the first 30 minutes or so is them at this, they're in Greece, right?
Yeah.
They're at this Greek villa, and I swear to God, I felt like they were at some kind of swingers party where they're all just like, I'm this guy, and I got this girlfriend, but I don't own her, and I'm a generous lover, you know? And let's talk about books and wine and passion, and we could kick around the soccer ball, and then we'll all butt fuck each other. How about that?
They all have very sort of interesting, enlightened things to say, and they're all very cultured, which, in theory, is great. We want to spend our time with people like this, right? I had kind of the same reaction to you. I didn't think that scene... worked, especially in the context of that movie. I don't know that it added a lot to their story.
No, I don't think so either. And I mean, like, and then the I think I really liked the middle scene where they're walking to the hotel the most, because when you get to the hotel, it's the best acted argument
yeah.
that you'll ever see in a movie, but it's also like the movie that you'll probably want to go back to the least out yeah. of the three, because who wants to watch an argument over and over
again? And it bumps. I mean, again,
yeah.
I can't knock the movie just for following through on its own intentions. Obviously, yeah. this is what they wanted to do, but it's hard yeah. for me to think about Before Sunrise and think, mm-hmm. and here's where these people end up. Like, that's as depressing as the end of World War Z to yeah. me, you know? Like, yeah. I want to just leave them happy and waiting to see each other again.
Exactly. Yeah, and I think they took the characters in interesting places, sure. and I thought that the conversations were all logical and they made sense, and you could, at one moment you were sympathizing with Ethan Hawke, and at another moment you're sympathizing with Julie Delpy, and I mean, like, it's very well written, very well done. It's just, you don't come out of the theater on that high that you do with the other two.
I felt like, and again, this is just yeah. for me, what I wanted out of it, it was missing sort of a third act. And it's not exactly, mm-hmm. structurally speaking, but I thought it needed to go one more place for me to love it. And yeah. it doesn't. It mm-hmm. just kind of ends where it ends, and you're like, oh, okay, great.
You wanted them
I have to go see Monsters University again. Yeah. I feel good about the world.
You wanted them to have three angelic daughters instead of
yes,
two.
Yes, come on. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Two is no good.
Yeah.
I like you said, incredibly well acted, very well written, well directed. Everything about it is good. It's just, it wasn't the movie maybe that I was hoping for. I believe you said you had rewatched a movie, perhaps in response to seeing This Is the End.
Yeah. Okay. I'm gonna coin something.
All right. I like it.
I'm gonna coin it the Patrick Bromley curve, where I had this happen to me with
Evil Dead. I have trouble with the Patrick Bromley curve.
Yeah, it's tough. You need to work it off at Curves Gym. Evil Dead, watched it.
Yeah.
Was fine with it. Didn't love it. Okay. Didn't hate it. Talked to you and JB, hated it. Pain and Gain, didn't love it, didn't hate it. Talked to you for an hour about it, hated it.
All right.
This Is the End. I saw it. It was all right. I laughed. I was a little disappointed. Then I talked to you about it, and I'm like, oh, I think there might be more there. And then I watched it again, and there is more there, and I liked it a lot. Observe and Report was something I saw once in 2009 when it first came out in theaters, and I was very excited about it, and I was probably at the highest peak of my, like, Apatow Rogan era fandom, and I just didn't like how mean-spirited it was, and I couldn't wrap my head around why they were doing that, and, why is Seth Rogen, who at his meanest was always maybe, like, the guy on Freaks and Geeks.
Right.
Or maybe, or like the guy in Donnie Darko, but that doesn't really count.
Counts to me.
Yeah. But when I rewatched Observe and Report, I kind of was ready to, we've talked about this before, you're ready to accept the movie on its own terms and not with what your expectations of it were. And it's very honest to that character, and it's kind of a hopeful movie for that character because he's proven right at the end, and he's seen as useful, and he's messed up, but everybody in that movie is messed up.
Yeah.
It's not like he's pretty bad, but like everybody in that movie is bad. So in the scheme of that universe, it makes sense.
Yeah.
And it's almost like an optimistic ending for him. And I thought that, you know, the stuff in it, it's still a really funny movie. It's a very dark comedy.
Yeah.
It's kind of shocking to see Seth Rogen that heavy again.
Sure.
It was really weird to
see he's creeping back up there a little bit.
Yeah, but no, I'm glad that I applied the Patrick Bromley curve to Observe and Report. And now I wouldn't say like I'm a huge fan of Observe and Report, but I like it probably, you know, it would probably go in like the lower half of like my top 10 list that I put up on like that Apatow column a couple weeks ago.
So. I love Observe and Report. I saw it not knowing what to expect in 2009, and I was just blown away because I'd seen The Foot Fist Way, and I still don't love The Foot Fist Way. Yeah. Like, I'm not maybe the world's biggest Jody Hill fan, but I thought just the filmmaking in Observe and Report, I love the way it's shot. I love the music. The
music's amazing.
And I never saw it as mean-spirited as much as very dark.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember getting to that climax And there were these kind of two younger kind of frat guys in the theater who were laughing so hard at the punchline to that. And I thought, I don't know if that's supposed to be funny. Like, I hadn't seen a movie like that where I got to a certain point, basically the climax of the film, and I didn't know how I was supposed to react. Yeah. And I was so fascinated by how conflicted and confused it left me. I love that movie.
Yeah, and every once in a while, I'll kind of have like a day where I think Anna Faris is a genius.
Yeah.
And after seeing her in that, that's one of those days where, yes, I'm just like, yeah, she's really,
that's
good sometimes.
Fearless, that, yeah, performance. That, yeah, is. She is not afraid to be the worst.
Yeah, it's a good movie.
Yeah.
And then the last thing is I saw Kings of Summer.
Oh, yeah.
I caught up with that. And I liked it, but that one character, like the
Biagio,
but thank you, I couldn't remember his name. Biagio, he killed the movie every time he showed up on screen, because one moment he's just like, you can't understand how this character has lived as long as he has,
right,
with the brain that he has. And then another moment he's saying something that's just purposely clever.
Right.
And it doesn't make any sense. It stops the movie cold in its tracks each and every time. And it's a shame, because there's a lot of stuff, like, I think my favorite stuff in the movie is when they're showing why they're running away. And they show their interactions with their respective families. Mm-hmm. And especially the kid from Super 8's, yeah, mom and dad. It's like this overbearing, just specific, like, overbearing and cluelessness,
right,
that's just perfect. And it's funny, like everything they say, especially like when they're trying to think of the movie Hancock and they can't. So they're like, I just saw that movie on the cable and it's called like Heimlich or Heim. It's got the new prince. The new prince is in it. And it's just like, you know, people like that.
Yeah.
And it's just, they don't know the name of the movie that they like.
Right, right.
It's just great. And but there's stuff like that Biagio character, and then the fact that, I don't know why, this is so stupid, it shouldn't have gotten in the way of my enjoying the movie, but I almost immediately like plugged out of the movie when they built
the
their
most
house.
Amazing treehouse you've ever seen.
Yet the one kid can't build a birdhouse,
right,
at the beginning of the movie.
Right.
It's like, well, what rules are you playing by?
Yeah, that's an issue. I'm glad to hear you say that about Biagio, because I, yeah, saw the movie back in April as part of that Chicago Critics Film Festival, and I liked it, and I think I've cooled on it a little bit since. I honestly haven't thought about it that much, and it doesn't seem like it's going to be the breakout indie that they maybe thought it was going to be. Like, I feel like it's kind of already done.
Yeah. Yeah, I had to go all the way to the city to see it.
Yeah. I really felt like I was at odds with what I was reading everywhere else, which was just, the movie's, you know, good, Biagio steals the movie. He's the, mm-hmm, he's the best thing. He's the breakout character. And I felt, yeah, the exact same way as you. Like, mm-hmm, this is from a different movie. This is a construct of a writer and an actor,
yeah,
that has nothing to do with reality. And it's not that it's the worst. It just, it belongs in a different movie. It doesn't work in this one.
I've seen, like, improvisers like him when I do comedy, and it's, unto itself, they're very funny.
Yeah.
But they've got no, they're tone deaf to what's going on.
And that's exactly
in the scene,
what it is.
And that's, and they stop everything dead in their tracks.
Right.
And that's what happened with the movie. And unfortunately, I think it hurts the movie,
yeah,
to a point where I can't really say I'm on board with it.
Right.
Yeah.
I saw one more movie. We're just putting off talking about The Sandlot that I'll talk about. And that is, I finally caught up with Jack the Giant Slayer.
Oh, Bryan Singer's.
Boom. The brilliant Bryan Singer.
Mm-hmm.
His reputation is officially reevaluated, right? That everybody's like, what were we? Why were we?
I was never on Team Bryan Singer to begin with.
Listen, I like The Usual Suspects.
I think it's overrated.
It's probably overrated. In 95, I really liked The Usual Suspects. I think there's a lot to like in the first X-Men, and I think he deserves some of the credit for the way that he treated the material.
Okay.
I think X-Men 2 is good.
Mm-hmm. I like X-Men 2.
And then I might be out on Bryan Singer.
Yeah. Yeah, Superman Returns, bad.
Not good.
Apt People, bad.
Never even saw Valkyrie, so I'm the worst.
Valkyrie's actually not terrible.
Okay.
It's like the Diet Coke version of Jack Reacher, where it's just like minor cruise.
Yeah, right.
But Yeah, what else did he do?
I don't know. Is that really it?
I think
so. Doesn't seem like that much.
Yeah.
He's been around a long time. Why hasn't he made more movies? I mean, don't get me wrong. It's fine.
Yeah.
Jack the Giant Slayer, did you see it?
No.
It's not the worst. Like, it's so not... But again, mm-hmm. I can say that now, knowing its reputation for being the worst, for being this huge bomb, for knowing that nobody liked it. Of course, my expectations are in the basement. So I watch it and I think, that's not the worst, and that's probably as good as I can say.
Nicholas Holt looks like my cousin Aaron, so like anytime I see the movie, like a movie that he's in, I'm just like, I'm not going to go see Aaron in a movie.
Yeah, right. It's a weird movie because it doesn't know who it's for. Like, it's too childish to be really sort of an adult fairy tale kind of a thing, like a Hansel and Gretel Witch Hunters. But it's also like giants bite characters' heads off. And so
it's like Troll Hunter kind of thing?
Maybe. Okay. I don't know. They seem to be pitching it at families, but I think it's too dark for families. Yeah. And it's a problematic movie, but I don't think it's the worst. Okay. Not the worst. Patrick Brownlee, F this movie.
Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everyone rush out and see it.
Yeah, everyone. It's so bad that in 2013, not the worst is just like, that's good word of mouth.
Yeah. Well, honestly, because I'm seeing all these movies that I'm excited about and not really liking, that it's kind of nice to see something that I had no expectations for and think, I don't feel like I wasted my time.
Exactly. Yeah, that's like one of my friends asked me, they're like, well, what movies are you looking forward to the most this summer? I'm like, The Bling Ring and The Conjuring. And they're like, seriously? And I'm like, that's where I've been so burned by every movie that I'm actually looking forward to.
Yeah, Monsters University and This Is the End, I think, are the two.
Those are
good. I haven't seen Bling Ring yet, but those I feel like are the two best things going right now.
Yeah, I won't say a grain of salt, but like, okay, do like a 1-star demerit on the Sofia Coppola movie thing for me, because I love her movies.
Sure.
So if I say it's like a 4-star movie, then to you it'll probably be a 3-star movie.
Sure, okay.
So
that's Erica saw it. She really liked it too. So.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk about The Sandlot. You guys have waited a half hour. Yeah.
Is that the longest run-up?
It might have been, but you know, we talked about a lot of new releases,
which
is good, because World War Z isn't going to get its own show, so
now
everybody can hear our thoughts. All right, so The Sandlot, 93, 20 years old, baseball movie. Saw it for the first time. I'm repeating myself. I had said at the beginning of the show that I think if you saw this movie as a kid, it's very easy to love. And interestingly enough, it pushed a lot of buttons that I like. I like the period. I like the nostalgia movie about like the guy looking back on the summer as a kid. It's Stand By Me. It's Now and Then. It's whatever. I like those movies. So I didn't dislike The Sandlot. I just had some problems with it, namely some tonal stuff in the performances. I just felt like a lot of the kids like were missing boogers hanging out of their nose. Like, that's kind of where the movie is pitched.
You didn't see it in Blu-ray. Huh?
I did not. And I thought all the stuff with the dog was kind of lame.
Okay. I grew up on The Sandlot, so like I saw it, not in the theaters, but I saw it like on video in 93. I was 11 years old.
Perfect.
And so it's perfect age to see that movie. I also grew up in a household that was very reverent of baseball. I was a big Chicago White Sox fan growing up, and a lot of it played in there. I played Little League, so I mean, like, I was the target audience. I was the perfect audience for it. To talk about, just kind of in summation, I said a few months ago, prior to my most recent viewing of The Sandlot, that it was my favorite baseball movie.
Okay.
After watching it,
yes,
I can't say that anymore. And it's not that I have something to replace it, but it is not nearly the movie that I remembered it being.
What replaces it?
All right. This is unforgivable.
All right.
I like Rookie of the Year, I think, maybe better than any baseball movie.
Wow.
Pound for pound, I will take Rookie of the Year over Field of Dreams, over Bull Durham, over Major League. Not saying any of those movies are bad movies,
right,
but Rookie of the Year. You want to know why Daniel Stern hasn't done another movie as a director? Because he fucking did it perfectly in Rookie of the Year. Like, he slayed it. That movie is a bizarre gonzo comedy classic.
I saw it in the theater. That was my first date with Doug. We like, that's the first time we ever like hung out sort of socially. So we joked that that was our first date. We laughed all the way through it. Not so much with the movie as at the movie.
It still counts.
I still haven't seen it since. No, because now anytime I see Amy Morton, including on stage at the Steppenwolf, all I can think of is her mouthing floated. And Doug and I still make that joke 20 years later.
It's one of Gary Busey's seminal performances.
I guess.
Chet Stedman, The Rocket. The thing that I feel bad, especially, I'm sorry,
Rookie of the Year,
Tom
Farrell,
because we've been talking about Rookie of the Year, but real quick, so like Gary Busey in that movie, he's got the most ridiculous throwing motion I've ever seen in my life, and after every pitch, he's grabbing his shoulder like his arm's about to fall off, but then the Cubs just keep him in there. If this were real baseball, the moment that he throws one pitch and makes like even a half grimace, they're going to be rushing out to get him out of the game. Anyways, I only brought that up because Rookie of the Year is on a double DVD with The Sandlot. And that's how I saw it. So, all right. The problem with The Sandlot is, ever since I became a great man and started watching movies, I, as an adult, I can pick out when things are not working from like a story structure or just like contrivances or cutesy bullshit, stuff like that. And The Sandlot is chock fucking full of like the parts that bother me about it drive me insane.
Yeah. Have you ever seen Lady in White?
No.
So this won't do any good, but I'll put it out there anyway for some of the listeners. The movie it reminded me of was Lady in White, which is that movie I like, and it has a ton of flaws, and it has that same sort of adult looking back nostalgia vibe. And it's very obvious, and we did a show on it where it's like a guy who had all these ideas and all these things he wanted to say, wasn't necessarily like a really polished writer or director, just channeled it all into one movie. That's how I feel about this movie. This guy had a lot of like different sort of disparate ideas, and I want to include this and this and this. Not real polished, sort of jams it all together. And I get why it works for a lot of people.
The writer-director is David Mickey Evans.
Yeah.
And he wrote Radio Flyer, which is an odd movie if you've ever seen Radio Flyer.
Sure.
He has
kind of a terrible resume. I was looking at it before we
first
recorded.
First Kid, which when I was a kid I liked. I don't know if it's still First Kid. But Sinbad is a national treasure. So, I mean, he did like 98% of the work for that. You just show up on set and you got a movie. And then he's done like a bunch of direct-to-video like Sandlot sequels.
Right.
And he also narrates The Sandlot. I don't know if you knew that. He's the Kevin Arnold of the movie.
Right. But then at the end, it's played by Arliss Howard, right?
Yeah.
That confused me.
Arliss Howard, by the way, and I've talked to Mike Primero on Twitter about this, Grown Up Smalls is the worst baseball announcer in the history of life. Like, the fact that he is an announcer for the Los Angeles Dodgers would make Vin Scully, like, they're like, all right, Vin Scully's not dead yet, but like, when Vin Scully dies, he will have to be rolling over in his grave at how terrible Arliss Howard is. And like, fucking Benny the Jet Rodriguez gives him a thumbs up. That has never happened, ever. So that's the thing that drives me crazy about The Sandlot is there are certain parts of the movie that get baseball and baseball fans so right, and there are certain parts of the movie that get it so wrong. But I want to talk about what I like real quick with The Sandlot. Okay, so the reason why the movie, I think, overall is a success is because you're seeing baseball through children's eyes, and that's when people love baseball for the first time.
Yeah.
There's no adults who just decide one day, I'm going to become a baseball fan. Baseball is something you either get when you're a kid or you don't get at all. And if you get baseball, you're going to have a lot of, you know, oh, I remember that moments with scenes where, like, you're playing catch with your dad or your stepdad in this case.
Or
Dennis Leary, who looks like he wants to beat the shit out of that kid, like, at every moment
of the
movie.
It's a weird decision.
It's very weird.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, how you can't really throw that well, and your dad's, like, trying to be patient, but, like, you know, inside he's just like, oh, God, why can't this kid just be, like, a naturally talented baseball player? There's stuff where, you know, like, the great Hambino, oh, gross,
is mimicking
Babe Ruth's batting stance. And, like, when I was a kid, I would do that with Frank Thomas or Julio Franco or Gary Sheffield. You would do that with your friends and things like that. So they get little details like that so right, and it makes me love the movie at times. But then there's stuff that just don't make any sense. Like, these kids love baseball, but they're not on a baseball team.
Right.
So, like, they have... And one thing that's nice about the movie is there's no, like, big game. But they have, like, a somewhat little game in the middle of the movie where they go up against, like, one of the Little League teams. It's like, why wouldn't these guys be on a Little League team?
Right.
They love baseball. So, like, it doesn't make any sense. Like, so I don't know.
I guess, you know, if I have an issue with that, it's that they, like, win handily, which is fine. But would it maybe not work better if they're not on a team because maybe they're not that great, but, like, they continue to play because they love it? That's the stuff in the movie that I like.
Mm-hmm.
I like movies that sort of focus on, like, I almost said I like movies that focus on young boys. like, when, like, young men are left to their own devices, like, in a group, like Super 8, like Stand By Me, like Kings of Summer, even, to a lesser extent. This movie gets some of that right, even though the way they insult each other always irritates me, because it has that just bad, like, PG 90s vibe. So I like that. I like that they're playing because they love it. And I could have watched, you know, more of a movie that's just sort of about that, their experiences on this baseball field. Instead, it takes all these detours. And I also like that it doesn't necessarily, and you kind of said this early on, like, mythologize or that it's not so super reverential to baseball. Because I'm not a baseball fan. I'm not a baseball fan. I don't watch baseball. Whatever.
Yeah.
So it's not like super reverent. It's not like Field of Dreams where it's like, it's literally magic. It brings back the dead. It's not super reverential to baseball, but then at the end, it's super reverential to baseball. Like, between the James Earl Jones stuff and that last scene at Dodger Stadium, it's like, come on.
And why does a blind man need that many autographed baseballs?
I don't know. I don't like the stuff with the dog. Like, when it turns into just, here's our wacky adventures with the lifeguard. And
if I would have guessed, I thought that would be the stuff that you would have liked more, because some of it has kind of a, and I'm not saying they're doing it as well, but, like, the stuff with the dog kind of has, like, a Joe Dante-ish thing, I think.
I just felt like it belonged in a different
movie.
It reminded me just of Chopper Sick Balls. Like, I...
Yeah. And by the way, when, like, the fence falls on the dog at the end, and then Benny and Smalls are trying to lift it, while these other fuckers aren't even, like, trying to save this dog, like, we're supposed to like these kids?
Again, I didn't dislike the movie overall. Yeah. I thought it was fine. I'm happy to have seen it, and I totally understand why it means a lot to a lot of people.
Who need to watch it again.
But I thought it was a weird choice, sort of the arc that they give to Smalls, which is like, he's a kid who doesn't have many friends, who's no good at baseball, which I can certainly identify with, because I was that kid. I couldn't play sports to save my life. And then, like, the second time he plays, he's good. And then it's just about him hanging out with these guys the rest of the summer. Like, there is no more character arc for him at all.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because there's two things. One, a positive, and then one kind of, like, a criticism of the movie is, I like that when he's learning how to catch, or, like, he's learning how to throw, like, Benny says, well, like, have you ever, you know, just throw it like you're throwing a newspaper.
Right.
Or, you know, just stick your glove in the air and, like, I'll hit the ball to you and everything like that. I like that because maybe the kid really wasn't as bad. Maybe he just needed somebody to, like, give him a little bit of confidence, like, just a little budge. And I like that because when I was in Little League, when I was doing baseball, I'll always remember when I was in fourth grade, I wasn't a great hitter at all. But then, like, I had a coach who told me, he's just like, this kid is a terrible pitcher, and you could hit a home run off of him right now. So it's kind of an odd thing to say, but he said it to me, and then, like, I went up there, and guess what? I hit a triple, and there was an error, but I got, like, a quote-unquote home run off of it. And then I was hitting for, like, the rest of the Little League season, because somebody just said, you can do this.
Right.
And that, like, flipped a switch, and that self-talk got better. So I like that The Sandlot has something like that that recognizes that. But I think that your point about the arc is interesting because they set this movie up as Smalls' movie.
Right.
And it's not his movie. It's Benny's movie.
Right.
And you kind of, are left scratching your head because they don't transition that well at all.
Again, it seems to me that...
like, Smalls gets into some shit,
right,
and Benny bails him out.
Right.
That's the whole movie.
It seems to me, again, yeah, that he was a fan of Stand By Me, and the, yeah, way that Stand By Me slowly comes into focus as being about River Phoenix,
yeah,
less than... I mean, it's still definitely about Will Wheaton, but it's about, mm-hmm, their relationship, and that he just decided to make Benny the River Phoenix character, although, yeah, it doesn't work because River Phoenix is, like, super troubled and, like, has a story to tell, and,
yeah,
Benny doesn't. Benny helps him out and loves and is good at baseball. Like, mm-hmm, that's the extent of his character.
Yeah, and Benny died in the Viper Room.
Right.
So.
I don't understand why even have the movie sort of be about this kid who's an outsider to a group who comes in and learns how to play baseball in the first 30 minutes of the movie and then just hangs out with them the rest of the movie, because none of that stuff informs really the rest of the story. So you could either... I'm not saying I want to watch an entire movie where, like, Smalls has to learn how to play baseball,
mm-hmm,
but why not just have it start and Smalls is already their friend and just have it be about this group of boys and their adventures one summer? I don't...
This reeks of autobiographical to me.
Yeah,
like,
again, that he just,
like,
has all these different ideas,
yeah,
that don't quite connect.
Like, I feel like the... And I could be wrong, but I feel like David Mickey Evans, like, was Scotty Smalls, and
right,
he moved in, and, like, he had, like, a... And I feel bad saying this because they were kids, but they're adults now, so I feel like I can say it. It's basically like the Brokeback Mountain of baseball movies. Like, Smalls loves Benny. Like, it's like, at the very minimum, it's an aggressive man crush. Like, he follows him around to his job with the Dodgers. It's an aggressive man crush. And Benny obviously, like, you know, gets a little... like buzz from Smalls because he's giving him hats and he's giving him gloves,
yeah,
and like this kid's got a fucking Sports Authority in his pants. Like, I don't understand, like, how has he got,
and
like,
Smalls wants to shop there.
Yeah, he does.
He wants to shop
there bad. But
did you see the post-credit scene where the
there's a post-credit scene?
Yeah, grown-up Benny and grown-up Smalls are just humping in the dugout.
Dugout
being the literal dugout. No, it's not a euphemism.
And then Randy Quaid says, I didn't pay you guys to stem the rose. yeah, so short digression there. But, yeah, it's... this movie sucks off Benny the Jet hard.
Yeah.
And I think that it's weird how they do that.
Because
he's never... seem to have any flaws or faults whatsoever.
Right, he has no real characteristics.
So he's a cipher.
He's right.
Yeah.
He's good at baseball. He helps Smalls. That's,
yeah,
all we know about him.
I even think it's funny that, like, the team, the Little League team that they go up against, they're all like, all you motherfuckers ain't shit except for Benny. Benny's the best. He's amazing.
Yeah, so this is David Mickey Evans, like, professing his love for the real-life Benny, maybe.
Yeah, who is Benny, David
Mickey?
Who's the real Benny?
I'm going to go with name a baseball player. I got nothing.
Tony Gwynn.
All right, it's probably Tony Gwynn.
Yeah, yeah. One part that shouldn't fascinate me, but now fascinates me about this movie, is the dream sequence... where Babe Ruth shows up Benny's room for two reasons. I know enough about baseball cards from my baseball card collecting days to know that the Hank Aaron baseball card, which is a little in-joke because Babe Ruth says, I feel like I'm going to need this for some reason, and that's because Hank Aaron broke Babe Ruth's home run record. That's the joke. It's kind of lame. That card is worth $1,800 now. So I have a theory that Babe Ruth comes in and just steals Benny's shit all the time. And this was the first time that he did it. So he goes in and he's just like, you know, heroes are remembered, but legends never die. I'm going to take this baseball card. And then like 10 years later, he's just like, oh, all for one and one for all. Can I have this VCR? And then he's just like, has your mother got a boyfriend? I feel like Babe Ruth is just going to be stealing his shit
But not before just giving shitty wisdom.
Yeah, it gets progressively worse. Yeah. And then he's just like, I need this. Give me $20. I owe bookies in heaven. He's just like, I thought you liked me. And also, like, I had this conversation with my dad. My dad is, he was around the age of these kids in 1962, which is when the movie takes place. And I said, would kids in Los Angeles or in California really give a shit about Babe Ruth, who at that point in time had been deceased for at least 10 years?
Yeah, right.
And played for the New York Yankees. So it would be like, I understand that Babe Ruth was kind of like, you know, he's like King Kong. He's right. Like an icon.
Right.
And I think they use Babe Ruth as opposed to maybe like Duke Snyder or somebody like that, who is like a Los Angeles Dodger and would make more sense because, you know, Babe Ruth is shorthand. You don't have to explain Babe Ruth.
Exactly. I know who Babe Ruth is.
Yeah.
I don't know Duke Snyder.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you should meet him. He will steal your shit in a dream. But I that part always bothered me because it's like not like they'll ever have ESPN Classic and they could see Babe Ruth games.
Right.
So why would they care?
Right.
Is it their dads are telling them about how great Babe Ruth was? Did they all transplant from New York to California?
Like you said, it's shorthand because I don't know who Duke Snyder is, but I would respect a movie that used that as the detail because that feels true to me.
Yeah.
Instead, it's like, well, they like baseball. I don't know. They like Babe Ruth. Okay, great. Yeah. That I forgot about that dream sequence. I did not like that scene.
But I gotta say, though, like as much as I'm having fun poking fun at this movie,
yeah,
I almost feel like a bully poking fun at this movie because it's so, its heart is so in the right place.
Sure.
But I just, I don't know. I feel like almost like I'm lashing out because I was lied to. Like I felt like the little kid Adam, like somebody told him this was a great movie and then like I watched it again and it's not. And I feel sad by that. Like I almost wish I just let it live in my mind and never came back to it.
Well, again, it's classic Goonies derivation where it's like, this meant a lot to me as a kid and I really liked it. And I totally understand it's pitched at that age. And so I totally get that. But yeah, to watch it as an adult, doesn't do the same thing.
I watched Rookie of the Year as an adult. That still holds up.
That shit still holds up. The whole pool sequence with the lifeguard, I don't know how old Marley Shelton was when they made this movie, so I won't comment too much on Marley Shelton, but I'm a Marley Shelton fan.
Mm-hmm.
Grown up Marley Shelton. She may have just been a teenager, so whatever. Yeah. The scene is fine, and if that was, like, the one detour the movie had made, I would have said, okay, fine, they don't play baseball one day, they go to the pool, and this kid did this thing, and it's, like, again, it's all him just pulling, I assume, from these biographical details, he had a friend who did something similar.
Yeah.
I just think the movie steps on that moment. I kind of like that it ends with her smiling at him a little bit, and, like, okay, great, and then the movie steps on it at the end by saying, like, oh, they got married, and they had a bunch of kids. Like, it's so kind of corny and too neat, and that whole sequence where they all disappear at the end, again, taken right from Stand By Me, like, are they all dying at that point?
Maybe the kid who got lost in the 60s died, but, alright, one of the tropes that I hate in movies is when they say, this is what happened to everybody.
Yes.
And it's always never good enough that it's like, oh, this person became a businessman or something like that.
Right.
They have to have some kind of like really cool thing.
He invented the mini mall. Right.
He invented bungee jumping. He got lost in the 60s. And then like they get to poor De Nunes, who they say, oh, he only made it to the minor. Like, fucking Smalls is so dismissive. You know what, you little shit. You're a fucking announcer. Like, De Nunes made it to the minors. He was a good baseball player, which he must have got a lot better after that summer because he got shelled that summer. Like, he gave up home runs to everyone. He gave up a home run to Smalls. Like, it's ridiculous. But yeah, everybody's got, like, these cool little things.
Right, always.
And that's, like, that trips up kids.
I'm just glad they didn't say, like,
I don't know,
5 years later, he went to Vietnam and died.
Well,
you know,
that's what happened to Bertram.
They didn't, like, Lost in the 60s.
He's lost in Vietnam. He probably still lives in Da Nang. They meant
he was on like a weird acid trip or like a joke that they couldn't make in a kid's movie.
Yeah.
Had they stuck with like Smalls continues to stuck at baseball, but loves it. And again, I don't ever totally get the sense that he loves it. I get the sense that like...
he likes having friends.
Exactly. Yeah. But he doesn't discover a passion for baseball, which is fine. Yeah. But he devotes his life to it. Although, as we've discovered, he's really just devoting his life to Benny. Like, I'll go wherever you are, Benny. Had they stuck with him being shitty at baseball, but loving it, then having him be the announcer at the end would kind of be along the lines of what we were talking about with Monsters University, which is like, I love this thing. I can't do it. I want to still find a way to be a part of it. Here's my strength. That could have all worked. But again, it's just this random, like, well, how do we get Smalls in the ballpark with Benny? He can't just be in the stands. Surely he has to be the announcer of the game.
Yeah. And I also think it's kind of weird how they bring in Benny to, like, pinch run at the end of the, like, at the end of the game.
Yeah.
And that means that he's, like, a bench player or he was, like, injured. And it's like, I thought Benny was supposed to be great. What's going on?
This movie's about the death of hope.
Apparently.
The death of hope.
Yeah.
I'm just amazed at how much of it focused on the dog, and I was actually a little bit relieved to see that in the middle it gets away from the dog for a little while, because early on it just kept going back to that dog and the narrator saying, like, the biggest pickle. Like, you love that line. You just keep repeating it. Because then even when I went on like Wikipedia to read about the movie a little bit and saw that like somebody sued the movie and, you can't sue a movie. He sued Fox. The poster that they have up is different from the DVD art. It's all the hands on the bat and the top hand is the fucking dog's paw. Like, this dog is so prominent that it's featured in the movie's marketing. Because I was liking the baseball stuff, and then it would remind me, like, oh, right, but this is a movie about how they have to get a ball back from a dog. And it's not totally. That just makes up sort of the last act, but...
I do like one thing about what they do with the dog is that they inflate kind of, like, they make it so much bigger than it really is, like, in their imaginations. Sure. They make it out to be the shark from Jaws.
Right.
And even, like, during early parts in the movie, they show the dog just, like, completely out of scale, and it's just obviously, like, how they're projecting their vision of this dog. And then, like, you see at the end, it's like, oh, it's just this, you know, junkyard dog and stuff that almost dies by having a fence broken on it, and they don't even care. But, and by the way, like, if I'm James Earl Jones, I'm not giving them back their baseball because I'm like, who's going to fix my fucking fence? Yeah. Look at that fence!
He just wants somebody to come talk about baseball with him. And here's the autographed New York Yankees ball.
How does he even know it's autographed? And I'm like, all right, if a baseball hit him in the eye and he went blind from it.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, Patrick Bromley, if you threw a DVD at my eye and I went blind, I probably wouldn't want to watch DVDs.
You wouldn't collect DVDs for your whole life?
I don't think I would collect DVDs.
You wouldn't want me to come over once a week and talk about DVDs with you?
No, that I would. You owe that to me.
I find the movie frustrating because at times
a cake goes in the air.
Oh, God. I forgot about the cake. Not that, again, it's a movie for kids, so I'm being way too hard on it, right? But, like, wouldn't it be a more interesting lesson if he's not given not just a ball to replace the Dennis Leary ball, but a ball that's way better? Like, look, everything is working out in my favor. And same with the Marley Shelton thing. Like, wouldn't it be more interesting if they do get kicked out of the pool for the summer, but he has this one moment, and then they got married and he fucked her so many times they had a ton of kids. That, like, it keeps selling, like... A more interesting lesson would be he did this thing, it was wrong, Dennis Leary was pissed at him. Mm-hmm. He eventually forgave him because that's how humans work.
Yeah.
And we move on as a society, but instead it's like, here's a diamond to replace your baseball. You just bought the Dodgers and invented the mini mall.
For some reason, when you said a diamond, I thought you meant like a Congo diamond. Or did you mean a baseball
diamond? No, I meant like an actual diamond. Oh. Like the baseball diamond from The Great Muppet Caper.
Nice.
So that kind of stuff bothers me. But again, it's a movie for kids, so do I really expect them to be like, and Dennis Leary beat the shit out of me that night. He divorced my mom.
Oh, man.
She remarried this drunk guy. Mm-hmm. Makes me call him Kevin.
All right, I got a really immature joke.
All right.
Not that it stopped me before, but I feel like I should set this up.
All right.
So, remember the part at the beginning of the movie where, like, Smalls is talking about how he's just an egghead and he's got the erector set, and
yes.
then, like, there is a pulley or something,
yes.
and there's a metal ball, and it hits Karen Allen right in the face when she's walking it.
Yes.
For
and
some
then she
reason,
shakes it off within a second.
Yeah. For some reason in my head, I thought it would be really funny if she said, "Man, twice in one night, balls hit me in the face."
You're right. That would have been funny. Movie would have taken a different turn.
Yeah, it would have been a little bit.
Especially if we saw Benny leaving her room.
Oh my god. He totally would leave her room.
Yeah, right?
P.F. Flyers, man.
I thought you were going to make a joke about Marley Shelton being an erector set.
Marley Shelton is an erector set.
Yeah.
She's a smart-looking lady.
She's terrific.
Yeah.
She's the bomb. I don't know what else to say about The Sandlot. I feel terrible. Somebody asked that we do a show on this. I saw the movie for the first time.
Yeah,
I feel
just like I'm being, shit on a movie I'm just that I actually even like.
Being way too hard on it. Like,
yeah.
It's totally fine. It didn't do it for me because I saw it as a man in my 30s. Like, had I seen this movie in 1993, I probably still would have been maybe a little bit old for it, but I certainly would have liked it more than I ended up liking it.
Yeah, here's the thing. This will stretch this out for maybe another couple minutes. Okay, here's the intrinsic problem with baseball movies now, and why a baseball movie, I don't think, can work anymore.
Okay. Tell it to Trouble with the Curve, but go ahead.
Oh my god. Amy Adams looks so cute in Trouble with the Curve.
I haven't
That's
seen
the
it.
Only thing that got me through that movie.
Yeah.
But anyways.
That would be the reason to see it. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm a fan.
Well, don't say the yet thing. Just don't watch it.
No, I guess I won't.
It's bad.
Amy Adams.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, here's why I think baseball movies can't work anymore. Because a lot of people in real life cheated in baseball. So you can't be romantic about something
right.
that people wholesale cheated with. I think in 1993, when this movie came out, there was obviously some steroids, but it wasn't like rampant like it is now. Kids today have grown up on cheating baseball for the last 10 years.
Yeah.
And you can't romanticize it anymore.
Yeah.
And I don't think that you can make a movie like The Sandlot, or even something like that. I think the only way you can make a baseball movie now is like Major League.
Okay.
Where you're just kind of like...
What if you do like the Any Given Sunday approach and you like blow the lid off that shit?
I would love to see that. I mean, like, I don't think that they ever have done that with baseball, which is...
Probably not, but that's because
yeah.
I think for the reasons that you're talking about, that people are so reverential and so nostalgic about it.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to go that direction.
Mm-hmm.
But I think now that, like you said, there's been 20 years of like... dark, shitty baseball.
Yeah, it's strange. But I think, and I don't know, maybe I'm projecting, like, a baseball movie can't work because I feel this way.
Right.
It's like Adam.
Right.
But, like, as Adam, like, the whole steroid era ruined baseball for me to such an extent that everything I see in it is just, like, negative and cynical, and I think that's maybe why I can't give myself over to The Sandlot like I did when I was
yeah.
a kid. Whereas if I'm watching Rookie of the Year, it's just classic filmmaking, and I can sit
if,
on
if
that.
If the movie were set in a period like 42, I didn't see 42, and they kind of get away with it
yeah.
by making it this biography.
Yeah.
If it's set in a period like where we are still sort of nostalgic and romanticizing baseball, does that work, or can you still not watch it because it's like watching Before Sunrise when you know Before Midnight exists, where you're just like, this is all gonna go to shit.
Yeah. Well, I didn't like the part where Ethan Hawke kissed Jackie Robinson's tits a bunch of times. No, I'm sorry. That's mean. That was from Before Midnight, and nobody's seen that movie. Anyways, but... So,
Jackie Robinson is in
yeah,
it, though. That's kind of a spoiler.
Yeah, yeah. Jackie Robinson...
The movie's about time travel. Have we not said that?
It is.
Before Midnight.
I forgot
yeah,
about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah.
Best sci-fi movie of the summer. 42 I didn't really care for that much because
okay.
I felt like it was, it's like, oh yeah, this Jackie Robinson and all the white guys who helped make this happen.
Yeah,
and it
right,
was,
right.
it was ridiculous. There's like one or two scenes that really worked because they really just make you just kind of sit in the stink of like the racism that he had to deal with. And that's smart. And
I
then,
sit in that stink every day, sir. Every day.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you need to stop sitting on that corner of that McDonald's.
It's my favorite McDonald's.
It's Racist Avenue. I'll have some slurs, please.
With barbecue sauce.
I just think 42 is just kind of, like, sloppy filmmaking. So I think that they can make, like, a good biopic of a baseball movie. But, I don't know. I mean, like, it's funny, you bring up Any Given Sunday. I would love to see an Any Given Sunday style movie based on baseball.
Are you a fan of Any Given Sunday?
More so than I should be.
I totally am, too.
I really like it. Steamin' Willie Beeman?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it's good.
Here's my problem, though. The only version that's on Blu-ray is the director's cut, yeah, where the guy steps on the eyeball, and I hate that scene so much that it sours me on the movie, but I kind of like that
gross
movie.
You out, or is it
Yeah, and I just
ridiculous?
Think it's... Both. Yeah. I think it's gross. I think it's just crazy gratuitous, and, like, that's what you had to put back in, Oliver Stone, you moron.
Yeah.
But I do like that movie, actually.
Yeah, exactly. It's a good one, but
I mean, they already made the Any Given Sunday style movie about basketball. It's called Blue Chips.
How dare you bring up Blue Chips?
I think it's the second podcast. I brought it up.
I think basketball movies have a worse track record than baseball.
Is there a really good one? Well, White Man Can't Jump is pretty good.
I love White Man Can't Jump. I mean, like, if you want to count
Celtic Pride, that's pretty good.
If you want to count Hoop Dreams, sure.
The Sixth Man, right? That's a movie.
What Celtic Pride has a, it's a bad movie, but it has a great line in it.
Which is what?
You've
been watching Celtic Pride.
It's sorry.
It's weird that they end the movie that way.
Yeah. No, there's a scene where, Damon Wayans is kidnapped by Daniel Stern, the great Daniel Stern.
Oh, right. Director of Review of the Year.
They've got all these pictures up of Larry Bird in their house. And Damon Wayans is just like, why do you got pictures of grown men in your house doing their jobs? Do you think Larry Bird has a picture of you, like, wrangling a turd? And I'm just like, that is so true. That's because, like, I remember the exact day that I stopped collecting baseball cards. I was like, why am I collecting pictures of grown men?
Yeah.
And I said to myself, why am I not collecting pictures of grown women?
And that's when you started on your card collection of...
erotica.
I'm sorry, porn collection.
Yeah, that's, and then Babe Ruth came to my room and he's just like, erotic baseball cards, meh. And I'm just like, here you go, buddy.
You got any dirty magazines for me?
You know what would have been great? If it's Babe Ruth, right? And he's talking to Benny, and then all of a sudden he turns into Freddy Krueger. And he's just like, you like baseball, Benny? And then they have, like, this, like, all, like, nightmare
scene. Yeah, totally, totally.
Where they're running around the baseball diamond, yeah. And then he's just like, you better fly.
Three strikes, you're out. Yeah, totally.
Why can't we see a nightmare on Sandlot Street? We're like, he's just like, hey, Squirts, want to kiss? By the way, Timmy and Tommy, the twins.
Yeah.
Didn't that one kid look like Martin Sheen to you?
No.
He was Martin Sheen. I swear to God, it's the second movie that Martin Sheen and Dennis Leary were in together after Amazing Spider-Man.
Oh, I forgot that both of them were in that movie.
Yeah. He's just like, Spider-Man wants to date my daughter even after I die and you steal my baseball.
Yeah, I didn't think he looked like Martin Sheen.
He looked like Martin Sheen.
I felt like all those characters were really underdeveloped, you know? Like, we didn't... Maybe because there were so many of them, I felt like Super 8, you got to know more about each of those kids than you do about the kids in the Sandlot, you know?
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
And that movie still has time for an alien, so Sandlot certainly could have had time for Freddy Krueger.
Once more!
Alright, that's it for the Sandlot. We've ruined it for everyone. Congratulations. We just ruined the Sandlot.
There's always a Sandlot on Elm Street.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next week. Bye, Sandlot Freddy.
Bye.
Ta-da!